We are talking once again with Maria Tomchik, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Starting out with local, Mayor Jenny Durkan apparently won't be talked quite about so much in the coming years.
Well, she will this coming year, but after that, not so much, because she announced this week that she is not running for re-election. Her senior staff and department heads claimed that they were stunned by this announcement, and they found out the news from the press because Durkan had not briefed them ahead of time, even though it was really clear that she had taken great pains to craft the message that she did when she did make her announcement. And it included an op-ed, I believe, that she wrote for the Seattle Times. So clearly she'd been preparing the news for a while.
And a pre-produced video that would have taken time to produce, you know.
Right. So it's interesting that she didn't spend any time at all talking to the city department heads to prepare them for the news. Mm-hmm. Now, there's been a lot of speculation, too, in the media, including here on this show, that she was not going to run for re-election next year. So it really shouldn't have been surprising to people within her administration. And I think it's a good time right now to talk about some of the really heavy issues that she's had to tackle in her term and why she's probably not running for re-election. So if we start with the fact that when she ran for mayor, the top issue of concern that voters had was the homelessness crisis in the city of Seattle and the lack of affordable housing. And Mayor Durkan has not done a whole lot to address that issue. She doubled down on the navigation team, which was controversial with the city council from the start. The city council had been requiring from the beginning that the city make quarterly reports on what the navigation team was doing and whether they were moving towards a model to get people housed rather than to simply push people around the streets of Seattle by taking their belongings and knocking down their tents and just sweeping encampments. And it was pretty clear to the city council that the navigation team was actually headed in the wrong direction, that they were doing less placement of people into supportive housing than they were just simply sweeping encampments in response to calls from businesses and residents of Seattle who were, you know, disturbed by seeing icky homeless people on the streets. So that was the first heavy issue that Durkan was confronted with and she failed to tackle. And then also during her term was the Amazon head tax fight, the employee hours tax, which the city council passed in order to try to pay for more affordable housing. And then Durkan, with the support of the business community, started lobbying city council members to try to get them to overturn that. And within a month of passing the head tax, the city council had voted to repeal it. Durkan at that time also said that she didn't favor a local city tax to pay for affordable housing and homelessness services because she favors a regional approach. And she pushed for and got the city council to agree on moving the city's homelessness programs into a regional, King County Regional Homelessness Authority, which unfortunately has failed to launch. And she and her staff have blamed the COVID-19 pandemic for that, and it may, you know, have something to do with it. But I think it's just really, really difficult, too, to gear up a whole new agency with other cities in the county, especially when those cities are resisting providing funding for that new body. And that's what we're seeing right now. Like this week, for example, in Renton, the Renton City Council voted to put in place requirements that would essentially ban supportive homeless shelters within the city of Renton. Now they said that, oh, these are just to, you know, give service providers some idea of what they need to do in order to, you know, have a legally well-functioning homeless shelter, but the requirements actually just make it so difficult for service providers to open new shelters in Renton that it's essentially banning homeless shelters there. So you have these suburban cities doing things that are actually make it more difficult to address the homelessness crisis. And I think they're also making it much more difficult to get the regional homelessness agency up and running. And that just has pretty much failed to launch. So that's a big failure of the Durkin administration. Now, she's also had fights with the city council over the appointment of Jason Johnson to lead the Human Services Department. And he has been since 2018. He's been called the interim director of the Human Services Department in the city of Seattle because the city council would not bring up his nomination and vote to confirm him. So again, you know, Durkin trying to say, look, you know, this is the person I want to lead this whole process. And the staff at the Human Services Department, as well as the city council, saying, well, you had promised a national search for a director for the Human Services Department, and you didn't do that. And so we're not confirming this guy who is essentially your crony and is very interested in doing data studies of the nature of the homeless population when there's already been a lot of information as to what the causes of homelessness are and who is living on the streets of Seattle. What we need are services, and we need a good relationship with service providers. And Johnson is not interested in that. So that was another big failure of her administration. There have been issues with the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract and police accountability, which are carrying over into the negotiations on the new Seattle Police Officers Guild contract in 2021. And remember that Judge James Robart has declared the city partially out of compliance because of the existing SPOG contract that Durkin helped to negotiate. So there's that failure as well. And of course, then the pandemic hit with the economic shutdown and the economic downturn, and that put a huge crater in the city budget. And then of course Durkin had a couple of fights with the city council again over the revised 2020 budget, which she vetoed and which the council overrode her veto quite easily. And then the 2021 budget, with the council's moves to begin defunding the Seattle Police Department and to shift spending away from Durkin's control and into the participatory budgeting process, which Durkin clearly has been opposing or has been at least ignoring, in a way that I find just astounding. Typically, when a mayor in the city of Seattle has gotten into fights with the city council, at least they kind of pay attention. The mayor kind of pays attention to what the city council is doing, whereas Durkin appears to just be always surprised and offended when she even acknowledges what the city council's priorities are, what they're doing. And I find that to be maybe a mark of incompetence. I don't know. And in addition, there were the demonstrations this year in response to George Floyd's murder, with the Seattle Police Department withdrawing from the East Precinct and the formation of the CHOP. That too was a black mark on Durkin's record, and Durkin making comments this year that she doesn't control the Seattle Police Department, so she can't tell them to stop using crowd control weapons against peaceful protesters, that leading to the lawsuits that Black Lives Matter King County and the ACLU have filed against the city of Seattle for using crowd control weapons indiscriminately on peaceful protesters and causing injuries and damage. And that too is a black mark against Durkin. The resignation of Police Chief Carmen Best, who, of course, Durkin at first didn't want to appoint as chief. And I think she really didn't support her very much as police chief. So, just kind of showing that Durkin doesn't quite understand, doesn't quite grasp the nature of policing in Seattle and what the whole police reform process means to communities of color in Seattle. And that the whole idea of police reform is to try to reach out to communities of color and find out what we can do to address their concerns about security and about how the police department functions. And I don't think Durkin has done any of that. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, she seems to neither have an understanding of the nature of policing here in the region, nor the nature of politics and how things work here in the region, as if she had been, I don't know, gone for the last three or four decades.
Yeah. And it's weird. Of course, she is a she was coming from a role as public prosecutor. So, you know, someone who works closely with police. So she should know the nature of policing. Of course, that means she's coming out of a culture that currently exists at the Seattle Police Department, which is resistant to reforms and resistant to changing the status quo. So that's been a real problem during her tenure, and really is why I think she negotiated such a terrible contract with the Seattle Police Officers Guild, which didn't markedly change at all the insufficient police accountability process in the city of Seattle. And then, of course, there were other issues too she's had to confront, like the closing of the West Seattle Bridge because of cracks in the main span. And the flack that she's taken from West Seattle residents for that. Now, the whole issue of deteriorating infrastructure in Seattle, especially transportation infrastructure, that's a big one. And that's one that no one and no mayor has been addressing, and that the city council really hasn't been addressing either, except in a piecemeal fashion as things fail. And I think that's the most expensive way to address the problem, but it's pretty clear that our deteriorating transportation infrastructure really can't be paid for entirely out of the pockets of the city of Seattle and Seattle residents. We need help from the federal government, and right now the federal government doesn't have the funds to do it. We'll see under the Biden administration, but I think the first big issue with under Biden is going to be COVID-19 relief, and that's where a lot of money is going to be going. Now, and then, of course, there was the recall petition against Durkin this year that led to a long, expensive legal fight and real questions that arose about her competence in running the city. And, of course, then we could see that Durkin has raised less than $5,000 for her 2021 reelection campaign. And if she were really serious about that, she would have raised much more money by now. So I guess the question is, who is running for mayor? That's the question we're going to be having in 2021. So far, there's only three candidates, and only one of them is serious and has raised any money, and that's Lance Randall. He's raised just under $10,000, with almost half of his contributions coming from individuals who live outside the city of Seattle, including folks in California and Georgia. Randall is the Director of Economic Development and the Interim Executive Director of SEED. SEED stands for Southeast Effective Development. It's a nonprofit that was established in 1975 to help with economic and cultural development in the Rainier Valley in Southeast Seattle. It provides business guidance and help to new businesses, to arts groups, and, of course, to property developers in Southeast Seattle to get the kind of startup capital and assistance that they need to expand. Its board includes folks from Banner Bank, Seattle Credit Union, T-Mobile, Kaiser Permanente, and a couple of local real estate developers. And its staff includes folks from different arts organizations and community members in Southeast Seattle. So Randall is definitely a pro-business candidate, but he's a person of color with connections to Southeast Seattle. And as far as I know, he's not a supporter of defunding the Seattle Police Department, and I don't think he's a member of King County Equity Now or Black Lives Matter Seattle King County. So he's not a progressive candidate, but he's very definitely a mainstream liberal pro-business Democrat. So he could be someone that the Seattle Chamber of Commerce could get behind to replace Durkin during the coming election. We'll just have to see who else declares their candidacy.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's going to be interesting.
That will be interesting.
All right. So we'll all be holding our breaths on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else on our current mayor?
Nope.
Okay. There was other SPD news this week.
Oh, yeah. A few things. First off, U.S. District Judge Richard Jones ruled this week that the city of Seattle is in contempt of court. His court order that the Seattle Police Department not use crowd control weapons indiscriminately against peaceful protesters. He ruled that of the many examples that were submitted in the lawsuit raised by Black Lives Matter, Seattle King County, and the ACLU, four instances were clear violations of his order. Four instances were not, and the rest, the vast majority, were unclear. He was particularly troubled by the high number of cases where he couldn't make a determination because of the lack of clear video evidence that was provided. The city had argued that it doesn't have control over individual officers on the street and that it had made a good faith effort to inform Seattle Police Department officers of the judge's injunction. Jones ruled that in agreeing to the court order, the city had admitted that it had control and responsibility for the behavior of individual Seattle Police Department officers, and at the very least, a responsibility to monitor the behavior of its individual police officers and to actually do something if they violated the court order, and that the city had failed to do that. So Jones ruled the city in contempt. On Friday, Black Lives Matter, Seattle King County, and the ACLU submitted their proposed sanctions against the city and the Seattle Police Department. They are requesting that the judge make the city do the following. The city must distribute information to all Seattle Police Department officers about the judge's order with, quote, clear instructions about what conduct is prohibited, end quote, and provide information about what consequences individual officers will face if they violate the order. Two, whenever Seattle Police Department officers deploy crowd control weapons against demonstrators, they must release a use of force report within 5 days along with body cam video that includes the 90 seconds before the action before the use of force and the 90 seconds after. The report also must list who deployed the weapon and how many of those weapons were used and why they were used when they were used. And three, the city must pay the legal costs for Black Lives Matter, Seattle King County, and ACLU attorneys to pursue this lawsuit. Those are the three things that the organizations are requesting that the judge impose on the city as punishment for violating the order. Now, the city has until next Friday to file their response. Then Judge Jones will rule and tell everyone what the sanctions the city will have to pay are for violating his court order. Also this week, Black Lives Matter Seattle King County sent a letter to Mayor Durkan requesting that she set up an independent group to investigate the Seattle Police Department and the Office of Police Accountability to find out who ordered the abandonment of the East Precinct back in June, why it was abandoned, and who is actually making decisions and reviewing those important decisions within the Seattle Police Department. Back in June, both Mayor Durkan and former Police Chief Carmen Best said that they didn't make that decision to abandon the East Precinct building when the CHOP was set up. And they both said it was a tactical call made by Seattle Police Department command staff in the moment, which obviously raised the question of who reviews major decisions like this and what are the consequences for making what was obviously a very bad and disastrous decision. Black Lives Matter is also asking that the independent body review the Seattle Police Department and the Office of Police Accountability's record in investigating only a few complaints and then not disciplining Seattle Police Department officers for excessive use of force during this summer's protests. Given that a federal judge has just ruled the opposite and is holding the city in contempt of court. So essentially they're saying, look, you know, the city has set up oversight of the Seattle Police Department in the Office of Police Accountability. And it's that body is failing to do its job. And we want an outside independent investigation of this. Also, you know, it looks like mid-level command staff are making very serious and important decisions that are not being reviewed by the police chief, the mayor, or senior command staff. And that means there may be elements within the department that are going rogue, that are doing things that are a problem. And we need to find out if we have competent senior level commanders. Now, so far, there's been no response from Mayor Durkan's office to this letter, not even an acknowledgement that they've received it, much less that Durkan is willing to even consider appointing an independent board. Also this week, Mayor Durkan asked the city council to lift its budget cuts to the Seattle Police Department for the rest of the year so that the Seattle Police Department can pay its officers for overtime used during this summer's protests. Now, you could see this as maybe a response to the letter from Black Lives Matter King County. But I think really it's just Durkan doing, you know, what SPD is asking her to do, which is essentially what she's been doing all along. She just ignores the city council. She ignores all these outside groups, including groups that represent members of the Black community in Seattle. And she only really responds to requests from the Seattle Police Department directly. So Durkan has asked the city council essentially, to let Seattle Police Department officers receive time and a half pay for abusing demonstrators this summer, in spite of the fact that the city council made it very clear in their revised 2020 budget that they were not going to provide any money for excess overtime this year. That was very, very clear. Teresa Mosqueda said as much this week, and this is a direct quote from her. She said, quote, "Our accountability partners were recommending less force and less of a presence, which could have been used to reduce the cost," end quote. So essentially she's saying, look, Black Lives Matter, the ACLU, other King County Equity Now, other members of the Black community and groups participating in the demonstrations themselves kept saying to the city council, look, there should be less of a police presence. Why did the police show up in such large numbers for every small demonstration when they haven't done it in the past? And on Friday, Mosqueda echoed this, saying, "I'm not interested in giving the department one more penny." And this is when the council voted on Friday not to lift the lid on SPD salaries for the year. But Durkan has also asked the council to lift 13 budget provisos that withheld a total of $2.9 million until the department cuts staff from specific units like the Harbor Patrol and their public relations department. The Seattle Police Department hasn't actually cut any of those positions because it would require out-of-order layoffs, and they're reluctant to pursue those and have been dragging their feet on that. But the department has also seen record attrition this year. SPD hasn't explained why they don't transfer those officers to other positions while they seek ways to actually cut those jobs, other than to say that those officers, you know, in the Harbor Patrol or in public relations aren't prepared for street work and need retraining, which I think is a really good argument in favor of actually cutting those cushy positions that are not providing actual police, actual boots on the street and actual policing jobs. So the council is going to consider that request to lift those 13 budget provisos on Monday. And if they do vote to do that, they have clearly indicated that they are going to vote to reimpose those provisos in 2021. Just to follow through with the Seattle Police Department and tell them, look, you may have drug your feet on doing the out-of-order layoffs this year, but you have to do them next year. Mm. So that's the news on the Seattle Police Department this week.
Oh, busy week.
Yeah, it's been a busy week.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think in addition to Durkan lending her ear to everything the Seattle Police Department is interested
asked for. In. Yes.
The other body that gets probably has a red phone in her office for is the Seattle Chamber of Commerce.
Oh yes.
So when that phone rings, she picks it up.
Oh yes, indeed, that's true. And this week, excuse me, the Seattle Chamber of Commerce filed a lawsuit against the Jumpstart payroll tax. This summer, the city council passed a new tax on big businesses based on the amount of payroll that they pay annually. It's a tax that will be paid by businesses. I just want to emphasize that. And there are provisions within that bill that passed that prevent businesses from passing the tax through to their employees or withholding it from their employees' paychecks. So employees don't pay it, okay? Businesses will pay it. And this week, the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce filed a lawsuit in King County Superior Court to stop the Jumpstart payroll tax from taking effect on January 1st. The main argument in their case is that previous case law has established in Washington State that earning a living is a right, not a privilege. Excise taxes, like the Jumpstart payroll tax, can only be levied on privileges, not on things that are a fundamental right. But the excise tax is not levied on employees' salaries. It would be paid by the employers, by the businesses. The real question then is not about the right to earn a living. The tax only applies to businesses and only businesses that employ people in the city of Seattle, and then only on businesses that pay more than $7 million in payroll to their employees and pay any of their employees over $150,000 per year. The tax is levied on the amount paid over that $150,000. So in other words, the question really ought to be, do businesses have the right to pay excessively high salaries free of tax in the city of Seattle? That's really what the question should be. So I think the chamber's legal team has a really hard job ahead of them. Their main argument is really beside the point. A better argument, I think, would have been to argue unequal treatment under the law for larger businesses with highly paid employees. But to make that argument, the chamber would have had to disclose details about which big businesses pay the most in payroll taxes, would pay the most in payroll tax, in the payroll tax, and what those businesses currently pay their most highly paid executives. That's a form of disclosure that I think Seattle Chamber of Commerce members are not willing to do. Right? Yeah. So in the meantime, the chamber appears to be gambling that the judge will issue a stay against the payroll tax taking effect on January 1st until the lawsuit is decided. And they're hoping to drag out the lawsuit, right, until a new mayor is elected, until they get some new people on the city council. Remember, there's two citywide city council seats that are going to be up for re-election in District 8 and District 9. Those are the two citywide positions this coming year. And those are currently held by Lorena Gonzalez and Teresa Mosqueda, who crafted the Jumpstart payroll tax. And I think the Chamber of Commerce is going to be working really hard to find some pro-business candidates to fill those two seats. And if they win those two seats, then they'd be able to put pressure on either Dan Strauss or Andrew Lewis to vote with Alex Peterson, Deborah Juarez, and the two new pro-business council members to overturn the Jumpstart payroll tax. So I think that's the strategy here behind this lawsuit, which on its face looks frivolous. But I think it's more a delaying tactic than a lawsuit that the Chamber of Commerce thinks that they can actually win. So that's what I think the strategy is here.
Gotcha. All right. Still sticking with local, the council this week is making some moves to deal with AstroTurf groups.
Yeah, the city council, governance committee passed legislation this week to require grassroots lobbying groups, is how they're referred to in the bill, to register with the city of Seattle and provide the sources of their funding. Now, before you go, oh no, that means every citizen has to register with the city of Seattle before they talk to their city council member. Let's look at the details a little bit. The bill defines grassroots lobbying groups as any organization that spends at least $750 per month trying to influence the public to lobby politicians to pass or defeat bills or to sponsor new legislation on any issues. The key here is how much money a group is spending. If, for example, an all-volunteer citizens group coordinates an email or social media campaign and doesn't pay for any ads or staff to run the campaign, then they wouldn't have to register. But groups that hire staff, pay consultants, purchase ads, etc., would have to register. So I think the example everyone is curious about is Socialist Alternative, which is the organization that supports Shama Sawant and that Shama Sawant is a member of, and its support for legislation that Sawant brings up and introduces in the council. According to this new bill, Socialist Alternative would have to register with the city since they do rely on paid staff. They print T-shirts and signs, make banners, they hold large rallies, all of which cost money. And I'm sure often costs more than $750. But then so would an AstroTurf group like Change Washington, which appears to be run by a public relations company based in Snohomish County. Change Washington has been urging the public to email the city council and local media to protest perceived failures in how the city of Seattle is being run by the city council. They would have to Change Washington because they're obviously relying on paid staff and they take out ads and do email blasts. They would obviously have to register with the city of Seattle and we would be able to find out who is behind setting up that group and who is funding them. Of course, if the full council passes the bill, they will also need to find money within the city budget to implement and enforce the new reporting requirement. And hiring one staff member would be an estimate, and you know, setting up the reporting requirement would take an estimated $150,000 to $170,000. In addition, the reporting requirement wouldn't go into effect immediately. There'd be a 6-month time period for the Department of Ethics and Elections to get the system up and running. So probably around midsummer, which would be right before the primaries of this coming election for mayor and city council, is probably the soonest that would go into effect. The city council is expected to, the full city council is expected to discuss and vote on this bill in the coming week or two.
That's going to be interesting.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
All right. Well, I guess that moves us on to national. This week's update on the pandemic.
We reached a grim milestone this week in the United States with more than 3,300 people dying every day from COVID-19. That's more than the number of people who were killed in the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001. That's every day in the United States now. The total death toll in the United States is now close to 300,000 people and will probably exceed that this week with over 15.9 million cases of COVID-19 reported so far. Hospitals are overwhelmed with rural hospitals and some urban hospitals having to send patients to other hospitals in order to address all their COVID-19 cases. And there are nurses reporting in inner city hospitals that they're having to treat people. They can't take all COVID-19 patients into their ICUs. They're having to treat them in the ER, which means that other people coming into the ER with injuries or needing treatment because they've been in a car accident or they've broken a limb or something, having to wait or having to be treated in hallways while COVID-19 patients are isolated in ER rooms because they have to be isolated. They can't be treated in the hallways because, of course, the risk of spreading the virus. Mm-hmm. So that is in other words, the number of COVID-19 cases is beginning to really overwhelm our medical system. Worldwide, the total number of cases we've seen almost 1.6 million deaths worldwide from COVID-19 and a total of about 71 million cases so far. Another grim milestone was reached this week when Trump crony Chief of Staff Mark Meadows bullied the head of the Food and Drug Administration to grant emergency authorization on Friday to the vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. So far, the Trump administration had been largely hands off with the FDA and their vaccine approval system. They had urged the FDA to work around the clock to look at the vaccines and try to assess their safety, but they hadn't really pushed them to approve the vaccine until this Friday, when Mark Meadows told FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn to be prepared to submit his resignation if he didn't approve the vaccine by the end of the day yesterday. That was clearly a political move, because the FDA had already said that it was on track to approve the vaccine by Saturday. But, of course, Donald Trump needed a positive win in the Friday news cycle. So, you know, out came the whip. And, of course, vaccine distribution will begin on Monday, as it was set to begin anyway. So, you know, issuing the emergency authorization a few hours early made no difference at all in vaccine distribution. It was just clearly a PR exercise by the Trump administration, or perhaps just a power exercise by Donald Trump himself. Of course, the first batch that's going to be sent out on Monday is just 2.9 million doses reserved for healthcare personnel and nursing home residents. Now, this first vaccine is already being used in Britain, where the healthcare service is recommending that doctors not give it to people who have serious allergies. So far, two people who've received the vaccine in the UK have experienced anaphylactic allergic reactions that may have been caused by the vaccine, but they don't know for sure. The British Health Service is asking Pfizer and BioNTech to do a separate, smaller vaccine study on people with serious allergies. Other groups of people were excluded from the initial trial, including children under 16, pregnant women, and immunocompromised people. So we don't know yet how those folks respond to the vaccine. And it would be a good idea, I think, if Pfizer and BioNTech decided to expand their trial to cover those folks as well. Now, there was also news this week that the Trump administration turned down the opportunity to reserve more doses of the vaccine for the U.S. public. The current contracts with Pfizer and with another company, Moderna, who are developing a second vaccine, are for a total of 300 million doses. That's enough to vaccinate 150 million Americans, because remember, each person needs two doses of the vaccine to be fully vaccinated. And 150 million is only 45% of the total population, right? So let's be clear right now, too, on what a vaccine will and won't do, okay? Because a lot of folks are seeing the approval of this vaccine as light at the end of the tunnel and are feeling very, very hopeful and saying, oh, hey, soon we'll be able to throw away our masks and go back to life as usual. And, you know, I don't want to depress you further, but we need to be realistic about what a vaccine does do and what a vaccine can't do, okay? So remember, vaccines don't always prevent you from getting the illness, right? You may still get sick if you've been vaccinated, just not as sick as you would if you hadn't been vaccinated. But you still can get the virus. Okay, that's something people don't know, and people assume I'll get vaccinated and I won't ever get the virus. That's not the case. That's not what vaccination does, okay? Now, if a vaccinated person gets mildly sick, they may still spread the virus, especially if they're feeling good enough to get up and leave the house, to go to the grocery store, to go to the drugstore, you know, that maybe they're feeling a little under the weather, they need to get aspirin or something at the drugstore, you know, but they're not so sick that they're laying flat out in bed. Being mildly sick may make you a super spreader, right? In addition, even a mild case of COVID-19 can cause long-term malaise for people. So we need to remember that many people who've recovered from even mild cases of COVID-19 are reporting that they're still experiencing things like chronic fatigue, muscle and joint pain, breathing problems, heart and artery disease, and neurological symptoms weeks and even months later. Some folks have been experiencing these symptoms for 9 months or longer. And that means that a case of COVID-19 could change a person's life and literally change the way they feel for the rest of their life. So that's something to take into consideration too. We need to be very, very clear that a vaccine is not a cure-all and it's not going to make us all immune from COVID-19. And the vaccine really means that, you know, if you get it, you probably won't die, but it doesn't guarantee that you won't get it. And it doesn't guarantee that you won't spread it. And it doesn't guarantee that if you get it and you, that you will recover fully and be the same person that you were before you got sick. And that's the reality that we all have to face now. And until we have more than 90% immunity and we don't have widespread community spread of the disease, we need to all continue to wear masks, even if we've been vaccinated, and we need to continue to be very, very careful who we socialize with and what we do. Now, I want to talk too for a minute about risk assessment, because it seems to me that people are they're not doing a risk assessment often, you know, and I have to do this every day because I'm still going to work every day. I am considered an essential worker in my workplace, and I go into work so that almost everybody else in my workplace can stay at home and work from home because I'm the IT administrator at work. I have to be there to take care of the computers, right? Mm-hmm. And so every day I have to do a risk assessment for myself about, okay, when do I wear a mask? Where do I wear a mask? Where is it safe to go? I can't be at home, so I can't accept deliveries at home. So I have to do my shopping. I have to go to stores, essentially, to do my shopping, most of my shopping. So I have to be very, very careful where I go, and I have to look in the windows and see, are people in that store wearing their masks? If they're not, I skip that store and go someplace else. So I just want to talk for a minute about risk assessment. Now, a recent study published by researchers in South Korea showed that indoor dining is particularly hazardous because 6 feet is not far enough to keep people from infecting each other indoors. In fact, 16 feet is not far enough, and neither is 21 feet. And you only need to be in the same large room as an infected person for 5 minutes to contract the virus. And you can get the virus from a person who has no symptoms. Okay, so let's go over those numbers again. 16 feet is not far enough. 21 feet is not far enough. And you only need to be 5 minutes in the presence, you know, more than 21 feet from a person who is asymptomatic and who's shedding the virus. Okay, so that really changes the risk calculus, right? The CDC has recently recommended universal mask use outside of your home. That means wearing masks all the time, indoors and outdoors, whether there are other people present that you can see or not see, because often there are people behind you you can't see, or people just behind a partition that you cannot see, and yet you're sharing your air with them. The highest risk places to go right now are bars and restaurants, even those with open tents, because no one is wearing a mask when they eat, right? Tables that are 6 feet apart are not far enough apart when people don't have their masks on. And that's even, I'm seeing these three-sided tents around town. I don't think you're getting good enough airflow there with the tables 6 feet apart in those semi-outdoor tents. And I think that this report really changes that risk calculation. And I don't think those are safe places to go right now. I think in addition to bars and restaurants, we have to all be really careful about any public or common areas indoors, like building atriums, hallways, elevators, mail rooms, laundry rooms,
stairwells.
Yeah, those are extremely high risk areas. And I'm still seeing people walking around in those public common areas without masks. And they're actually, doing their best to get the disease, and they're doing their best to spread it. So I think we need to be really careful with our risk assessment and really take the CDC seriously when they say mask use everywhere outside your home. So we need to start considering those public spaces, even when you're outdoors exercising, as high risk. And there have been other studies, too. There was a recent study looking at people exercising and asking, okay, does mask use interfere with your ability to breathe or your ability to oxygenate your blood when you're exercising? And what they found is that no, mask use does not interfere with your ability to get oxygen to your muscles when you're exercising. That a person going out for a run with a mask on, you're feeling that, if you're feeling that you're having trouble breathing or getting enough oxygen, it's probably just because you're not used to having something over your face. It's not because you're actually experiencing any reduction in oxygen to your bloodstream or to your muscles. So there have been studies on that, and it's shown that you can actually be outdoors with a mask on. You can be out exercising. You can even be breathing hard when you're exercising, and you're still getting pretty good oxygen, especially with a cloth face mask. If you're wearing an N95 face mask, you might have trouble. But people out exercising shouldn't be wearing N95 face masks. Those should be reserved for healthcare personnel. You should be wearing a cloth mask.
And as I discovered the beginning of this week with the cloth masks, that once they get significantly wet, they are really hard to breathe through.
Yeah, it's a good idea to be carrying a spare.
Yeah, maybe at least one spare if you live in a either a super hot, humid region or a very wet, rainy region.
Carry a spare or maybe a couple spares. And, you know, when you're exercising, you sweat, so your mask is going to get wet. Yeah. So,
just a new factor to calculate in.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, you have more on that?
No, that's my COVID update and a little lecture there and, just unpacking some of the new information that we got this week about the virus.
Okay. So that leaves us about 10 minutes for an update on Mr. Biden's cabinet.
Yes. This week he appointed some key positions, Lloyd J. Austin III as his Secretary of Defense. Austin is a retired U.S. Army four-star general who served as commander of U.S. forces in Iraq from 2010 to 2011. Then he was promoted to Vice Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army from 2012 to 2013, and then promoted up again to become the first black head of U.S. Central Command, better known as CENTCOM, from 2013 to 2016 when he retired from the military. He has since served on the board of U.S. defense contractor Raytheon Technologies, which folks might know Raytheon as a company that makes fighter jet engines, weapons, high-tech sensors, and billions of dollars worth of equipment for the U.S. military and for allied nations, particularly nations in the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia. So there's a question there of conflict of interest, obviously. He has also served on the board of Nucor, which is a major steel products company, which provides a lot of steel for the defense industry, as well as other industries like the oil and gas, like big oil and gas companies. Now, he's a longtime friend of Joe Biden. He worked with him on U.S. troop deployments in Iraq, obviously. Later, as head of CENTCOM, he oversaw the fight against ISIL in Iraq and Syria and the U.S.'s failed program to train an opposition force in Syria. Not much is known about Austin personally, since he doesn't like to speak to the press, and he's considered more of a technocrat than a charismatic leader. Austin may fall short in a couple of very major ways. First of all, he's a former general in a job that's usually reserved for a civilian, and in fact, traditionally reserved for a civilian. The Secretary of Defense is supposed to oversee policy in the department, so of course they need to be a politician, right? And not be buried in the details. Austin is a detail man, and he's known to prefer sending in the troops whenever possible. That's a pretty typical failing for a former general, right? Also, another way in which he, I think, is not really qualified for this position is that international conflict these days is less about boots on the ground, and it's more about bots on the internet. Austin knows about the former, but he really doesn't know much about the latter, apparently. He's had a lot of experience in the Middle East, but I think he knows very little about Russia, China, and North Korea, or about cybersecurity risks. He's also not very knowledgeable about international trade issues and about the ongoing kind of economic war between the United States and China. So I think that makes him not a very good pick. And because Austin has never served in a political role or a political office, we just don't know anything about his stances on foreign policy issues. So a bad choice all around, I think. Now, for Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Biden picked Marcia Fudge. She's been a U.S. House representative from Ohio for 12 years. She sits on the House Agriculture Committee, the Education and Labor Committee, and the Committee on House Administration. She's a former chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. Her particular issues of interest are nutrition and food programs, equitable access to education, fair labor practices, and civil rights and human rights issues. She's a big supporter of social safety net programs like Social Security, Medicare, and SNAP, which is the food stamp program. In fact, some Biden supporters had urged her to run the Department of Agriculture because they thought she'd be a strong advocate for farm workers and for folks on food stamps, which is a program administered by the Department of Agriculture. Instead, she's going to be running the Housing and Urban Development Department. She's going to have a big job restoring support for housing programs that have been gutted by Ben Carson and the Trump administration. And that includes Section 8 vouchers, rental assistance programs, housing programs for the elderly and disabled, and programs to support public housing. In addition, she'll be working to reactivate fair housing standards and rules that Carson worked to gut and dismantle. So that's a big job for her. She's a very good pick for this. She would have been great, I think, as Secretary of Agriculture, but I'm happy to see her in any role in Biden's cabinet. Tom Vilsack, on the other hand, as Secretary of the Department of Agriculture, is probably the worst pick you could have imagined for this job. Vilsack served as Secretary of Agriculture under Barack Obama from 2009 to 2017. Before that, he was governor of Iowa from 1999 to 2007. During his tenure as Secretary of Agriculture under Obama, he had the support of big agribusiness and was a huge advocate for subsidies for corn-based ethanol as a quote-unquote green fuel. He was also on good terms with the biotechnology industry and was a noted supporter of pink slime. That's the so-called food product made from beef carcass trimmings that were formerly discarded as inedible. Pink slime is often sold to schools as a beef product that could be used to make hamburgers or to make ground beef stretch, right? He also did nothing to address farm worker safety, and he oversaw rules that allowed hazardous speed-ups in poultry processing plants and further deregulation of slaughterhouses and meat packing plants. In addition, he refused to address racial disparities in farm loans and did nothing to stop USDA foreclosures on black farmers who had pending civil rights complaints. He's a very bad pro-corporate, pro-factory farm choice for the Department of Agriculture. But I think it's pretty typical of how the mainstream Democratic Party has treated rural communities for decades. And I think that's a policy that needs to change. And Biden should have listened to the progressives in his party who urged him to appoint Marcia Fudge for the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture. And instead, he just lapsed and decided, I'll just pick who Obama had. And I think that was a very bad choice. Now, also this week, Biden announced his Secretary of Health and Human Services will be Javier Becerra. Becerra has been serving as the Attorney General of California, and he's formerly a U.S. House representative from Los Angeles. He was chairman when he was in the House. He was chairman of the House Democratic Caucus from 2013 to 2017. He was also chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. In the House, he served on the Ways and Means Committee and its subcommittees on oversight, health, and Social Security. He also served on the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction while he was in the House. So he has the background to understand financial statements and fiscal issues, which I think is a must for whoever runs Health and Human Services, because he's going to be overseeing Medicare, Medicaid, and particularly Obamacare. And in the past, he has expressed his support for Medicare for All, which means he may be open to making progressive changes to how the federal government runs healthcare. Now, Becerra may not make it past Republicans in Congress because as California's attorney general, he's filed at least 62 lawsuits against the Trump administration. And he's led a lawsuit with 24 other state attorney generals to defend the Affordable Care Act from the Trump administration's attempts to completely dismantle it. So he has that baggage that he's bringing with him. It means he would be a good HHS secretary. But it also means that he may have a hard time getting confirmed if Republicans control the Senate. We'll find out come the Georgia elections on January 5th whether or not that's going to be the case. And then finally, Biden fell back again on a friend and a former Obama-era official when he appointed Dennis McDonough as Secretary of Veterans Affairs. McDonough was a former chief of staff in Obama's second term. So his appointment really shows that Biden likes to hire people that he's worked with previously and that he has a relationship with. Okay. And then finally, two other picks, Rochelle Walensky as chief of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She's the current chief of infectious diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital and a very good and very professional pick to run the CDC. And Dr. Vivek Murthy as Surgeon General. He served as Surgeon General under Obama. And both of these folks are very qualified, and they mark a real return to the reliance on science and on medical experts to run these very important public health agencies. So that was good news. There are still some positions that are left to be filled. The big open seat is for Attorney General, and a lot of progressive groups are urging Biden to pick a black man or woman to fill that position, although I'm not sure he's tending in that direction. It would be great if he did. Under Obama, he always picked a black man. He picked first a black man and then a black woman to run Justice Department as Attorney General, and that made a real difference for police accountability. Here in the city of Seattle, it made a big difference for us in terms of getting police reform started in our city. It would be nice to see that happen again under Biden, but we'll see. He's expected to announce his Attorney General very soon. Other positions that are left to fill include Department of Interior, Commerce, Labor, Transportation, Energy, Education, the EPA, and of course the CIA director. So we'll see who he comes up with in the coming weeks.
All right. Well, with that, we're pretty much out of time.
Okay.
And we will talk to you, perhaps also
Josh. Next week.
Next week. Same time, same channel.
Yes.